Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, what we now know about the core principles of President Trump's foreign policy. He outlined some of his thinking before world leaders at the 74th General Assembly yesterday in New York. The presidents and prime ministers and ambassadors come together at a time when there are new flashpoints and simmering disputes and changes to the Trump administration's foreign policy team. Today, what do we know about how Donald Trump conducts foreign policy on behalf of the American people, and what kind of a ripple effect is it having with our allies and foes? As our guests join us, I'd like you to think about this as an American voter. Is President Trump's foreign policy consistent and clear to you? Do you know what's at the center of his thinking on foreign policy? Do you feel like you could articulate what he stands for in this part of his job as president? So talking foreign policy this morning, and I'm asking you whether you believe that he has been consistent and clear on his foreign policy. Would you be able to articulate what's at the core of it? And do you think that he has fulfilled much of what he talked about as a candidate when it comes to foreign policy? 800-242-2828, wherever you are here in the Upper Midwest region, 651-227-6000 within Minnesota, and on Twitter at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Ellen Lapson is with us. She's director of the Master's in International Security Program at George Mason University, and with us today from Bethesda, Maryland. Ellen, welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be with you.
Stephen Cook is with us. He's Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at Council on Foreign Relations, and he joins us today from D.C. And Stephen, welcome. Good to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Stephen, one of the things that I wondered about as I watched Speaker Pelosi's statement yesterday about the impeachment inquiry is how the rest of the world sees Washington about to embark on this, and what it means in a larger sense with the kind of interactions that we will be having on foreign policy issues that arise. What does all this mean?
It's a great question, and I spent a good part of the first half of this year traveling abroad, and I will tell you that I think all of my interlocutors, the first question was, what is going on in Washington? I think they're bewildered by the political polarization and the political dysfunction that they perceive from whether it was the Middle East or Europe or North Africa. And they're quite worried about it. They see the United States becoming increasingly insular and unable to lead. And these are countries that have long looked to the United States to lead on a variety of issues, whether it's trade, whether it's European stability and security, whether it's peace and stability in the Middle East. These countries have come to expect the United States to play a leadership role. And what they perceive is the president not as committed as his predecessors to playing this role.
So I guess, Ellen, are your contacts internationally telling you the same thing? And is what Stephen just described more about the policy with which President Trump pursues foreign policy, this more insularity that Stephen mentioned, or is it a consequence of the kind of divisiveness and the distraction that has been going on?
So, well, first, I think at the strategic level, we are President Trump, and he's not the only leader around the world, is returning to a more traditional nationalism versus seeing the international system as somehow, you know, ideally a cooperative system where conflict can be avoided, et cetera. Tactically, I think that President Trump's unpredictability was very stressful for many countries in the first year. but is now becoming predictable. So the unpredictability becomes predictable, and that you can start to pull some threads of, you know, kind of essential belief system in President Trump, so that there's a, you have to make the distinction between the noise, the rhetorical blasting out of impulsive comments about everything in the world that initially I think was very disruptive and disturbing to our allies and partners. And now they're a little bit learning how to brush off the noise and look for the, you know, what's the real ground truth of American policies. So it's a very, it's a messy picture, but there's, I think we can now discern a little bit more texture to it. The other thing about traveling and listening to people outside the United States is I would make a distinction between Europe and Asia, that I think the Europeans truly feel that the, you know, rug is being pulled out from under them, that their whole identity and their whole security thinking and strategy has been so connected to the United States for so long that his disdain for NATO, his very uneven, disrespectful behavior towards major allies really has rattled them. And in Asia, it feels a little bit different. It's like, well, we were planning to set our own agenda without the United States anyway. So I think the Asians, to some extent, maybe Japan and Korea are exceptions, but the Asians in general have had less of a kind of, you know, emotional reaction to the Trump administration.
You know, I'm going to come back to Euro versus Asia because that there's a lot more to explore there. Want to note that as we came on the air this morning, the White House was releasing a memo that summarizes this July 25th call with the Ukrainian president. And the Associated Press is reporting here that President Trump repeatedly prodded Ukraine's new leader to work with Rudy Giuliani and the U.S. Attorney General to investigate Democratic political rival Joe Biden. Again, that is a five-page memo that summarizes this call that occurred on July 25th. More reporting, of course, as the morning goes on. Stephen, I'm also interested in the position that this puts Ukraine in. I mean, here they are trying to fend off Russian-backed separatists. They need the money that the United States gives them to pursue that and some of their other foreign policy goals. And they're looking at a situation where President Trump could be reelected, a Democrat could be reelected. This seems like a very... This feels like a moment that's just filled with landmines for them. Describe the position they're in.
I think, you know, the Ukrainians find themselves once again pulled into the American electoral cycle, a place that they don't necessarily want to be. I think the new Ukrainian president's ability to resist President Trump was speaks well of him and speaks well of the fact that Ukrainians do not want to get involved and that they are looking ahead to the possibility of a new administration coming in. Of course, nobody can guarantee that that'll happen. But they are in an extraordinarily delicate situation. They are vulnerable to the Russians. As Ellen pointed out, in Europe, there are serious questions about America's commitment to its security. As the Russians become more aggressive in Europe and try to weaken Europe and weaken NATO from within. So it's almost as if the Ukrainians are damned if they do and damned if they don't.
Yeah.
But I think the appropriate position for them to be in is to not cooperate with the president, especially since this was quite obviously an effort on the president to use the national security of the United States, the foreign policy of the United States, to advance his own political interests, which is at the very least inappropriate.
Ellen, let's speak to this position that the Ukrainians find themselves in. Some of their initial statements have, in fact, I saw an interview with the foreign minister who said, hey, from our view, nothing inappropriate happened here. And I wasn't sure how to interpret what was happening, particularly given what we're now seeing this morning.
So I can't speak for what he was trying to convey, whether it was nothing inappropriate happened when Biden asked for the prosecutor to be removed or nothing was inappropriate in the most recent phone call. between the two leaders. And it's possible that Ukraine's interest is in, you know, making this seem like normal, and they're going to try to not stir the pot. But I think we want to maybe add just a thought or two about the larger context. Newly democratizing countries turn to, you know, America's political operatives. Remember Paul Manafort, remember Mike Flynn. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys were making money in countries that requested help from the American, you know, political machine, if you will. And it was always awkward. I mean, to me, it was always running the risk of crossing lines of conflict of interest, et cetera, particularly when those political operatives want to go back into the U.S. government. So let's just remember that there's a larger context here, that whatever happened between Biden and Hunter Biden and, you know, relationship with the American, and it wasn't just the American position, it was the European position as well, to try to remove this prosecutor who was alleged to be a corrupt figure. Individual Americans were part of that system, you know, for a number of years now. And so now it comes home to roost.
Scott says on Twitter, we complained about China stealing our IP and manipulating our currency. We tried diplomacy for decades. Didn't work. When Trump tried to be tough, everything is wrong now. I need to speak language that others understand. There can't be one solution fits all. Start nice, followed by toughness. Here's another listener who says, it's clear that Trump's foreign policy is whatever serves Trump's ego and his businesses. That seems to be the only consistency. To the phones. Hey, Melvin, hi.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
What'd you want to say?
Yeah, I was agreeing with that last statement that the main purpose of the foreign policy is to enrich himself and his contributors, especially the oil industry with the Saudi Arabia thing. This last revelation about the Ukrainian conversation certainly indicates the collusion that he denied the whole time with foreign governments to manipulate our election in order to stay in power.
So, Stephen,
to continue to enrich himself.
I
so
hear you,
totally
Melvin, on this.
So,
Stephen, so here's, I think, the thing that we will tease out a bit, whether as President Trump acts on behalf of the principles that he holds about foreign policy, does it too often look like he is also serving himself in, you know, serving those principles? That's always difficult, I think, also to take apart what is good politically for the CEO of the country, the commander in chief, and what is truly good for America.
It's a great question, and I want to tread carefully here so as to not sound as if I'm engaging in any kind of partisan politics and sticking to analysis. And I think that the answer is to your initial question is both. I think the president ran on a platform of America first, and he has pursued that in a number of places. China, for example, in Latin America, he has done that. To some extent, he has done that in the Middle East in the most recent episode with the attacks on Saudi oil processing facilities. The question that Americans need to answer is whether America First is really benefiting them. I think that in the case of the tariffs on China, it strikes me that American consumers are paying much more for goods as a result of those tariffs. So America First in this situation is clearly not benefiting Americans. When it comes to Latin America and the concerns about migration from the South, the Trump administration has pursued a policy that is, I think, extraordinarily counterproductive by cutting aid to sender countries like Honduras and Guatemala and others. I think that if the United States was invested more in the development and security of those countries, there would be less people coming across the border. This is something that we did 25, 30 years ago with regard to Mexico, and Mexico became a real partner, the economic partner, security partner of the United States. The president seems to respond to what's going on in the world by America First, because mm-hmm. that is his platform, and mm-hmm. it's very hard right. at times to disentangle what's good for the president politically and now I'm separating this from his family business,
right,
what's good for him politically to get reelected and what's actually in the interest of the country. And I think in these discrete examples, America First really hasn't served the American people.
So, Ellen, this is something that I was thinking about yesterday morning as I watched his speech to the UN, and we pulled out an excerpt. One of the first things that he said about kind of where he's been in his administration and how he sees how America interacts with the world. Listen.
Wise leaders always put the good of their own people and their own country first. The future does not belong to globalists. The future belongs to patriots.
And what do you hear in that, Ellen?
Well, I think there is a kind of nostalgia for a sort of mid-20th century world where America was this, you know, preeminent, enriching country where prosperity was growing and our security was strong, et cetera, where, you know, we got to choose when we wanted to cooperate with other countries or not. What's happened over 50, 60, 70 years is a network of interdependence, whether that's economic interdependence because of globalization or institutions that have emerged where most problems cannot be solved by one country alone, that it always requires some group of countries working together. And Trump is dismissing all of that. He's saying, well, it turns out that because there was a downside to globalization, because it actually redistributed wealth and goods away from the United States, somehow let's turn the clock back and go back to a simpler system where every country is out for itself. And that's the world that he imagines. It is a little jarring to hear it at the UN General Assembly, considering that that organization was created to promote greater interstate cooperation to prevent a future world war. Now, Trump also has a message that's very, you know, non-militaristic. He,
right.
I think he is trying to associate himself with sort of peaceful resolution of conflicts or avoidance of conflicts. He doesn't really want to use his military tool if we listen to him carefully. But it is that return to a world of just single sovereign nation states where each one is responsible for its own interests.
You know, Stephen, this is a good moment to bring up this piece that you wrote for Foreign Policy magazine, where you were analyzing President Trump's response to the drone strikes of the Saudi oil infrastructure. And this is part of what you wrote. That's why this moment, the aftermath of an attack on Saudi Arabia's most significant crude oil processing facilities, is so important. How the Trump administration responds will indicate whether U.S. elites still consider energy resources a core national interest and whether the United States truly is on its way out of the Middle East entirely, as so many in the region suspect. Could you expand on that a bit?
Sure. I've been thinking about this question about the Middle East and the American presence in the Middle East. It's been a very tough almost two decades. And the conversation and debate among the American foreign policy establishment writ large is in some ways confused. And it's unclear to people what exactly the U.S. mission is and what is important to the United States in the Middle East any longer, and what the future holds for it. And for the previous 70 odd years, the United States has made it a central interest of the United States to protect the free flow of oil out of the region. If that's no longer an interest, if the United States doesn't see that it's worth it to invest in defending and sacrificing for that interest, something that we have made an interest for quite some time, then it strikes me we are moving into an era where we're going to have a very different posture in the Middle East. Now, that may be a good thing for the United States, but what it does is it sends the message to regional allies and adversaries that essentially that they're on their own. I think the Saudis and the Emiratis in particular have gotten the message that they are on their own. And I think that at least the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps has learned over the course of a series of incidents since May, whether it's the mining of tankers, the shooting down of an American drone, whether it's the taking tankers hostage, and now this incident, that the United States is unlikely to respond in any kind of military fashion, which also has the knock-on effect that if the United States and Iran ever do get back to negotiations, Iran will be in a much strengthened position in comparison to the United States.
And yet, because I know you've got just a couple minutes left with us, Stephen, isn't he, as Ellen suggested, taking his cue from voters who say, too long in Iraq, haven't gotten out of Afghanistan, yes, we want to have the capability, but we don't want to use it as often as we have in the past. We've learned from that. Isn't President
Trump—
undoubtedly.
Yeah. Undoubtedly, he is taking that cue, and that's one of the reasons that he was elected. It's also one of the reasons why his predecessor was elected, who felt that the conflicts in the Middle East in which the United States was engaged was actually sapping the power of the United States. So now what this requires are people like Ellen and myself to rethink and put out some ideas about how we really should be engaged with the Middle East, if at all.
Stephen, I really appreciate the time and the insight. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Ellen, I'm very sorry I have to go.
I am too, but I'm glad Ellen continues with us. And Ellen, would you, some thoughts on what Stephen left us with there?
So let's go back to the energy question, if we could, for a minute. It is true that as the United States becomes now the largest exporter of oil in the world, or the largest producer, I believe, we are much more energy self-sufficient than we were, say, in the 1970 oil crisis, where we were kind of in a panic that if the, you know, Gulf countries stopped trading, shipping oil to us, we were going to have a huge energy crisis at home. So we are more confident. We're in a stronger position. We're more self-sufficient in terms of energy. But we do want to go back to that principle that Steve mentioned of whether one of the American roles in the world is to be the guarantor of the free flow of energy as part as our contribution to kind of the world economy, to the international economy. So for a number of years, we've been saying, even if we don't personally need Saudi oil anymore, or we need a smaller and smaller percentage of it, the rest of the world needs it, and so we still believe it's in the interest of world peace and stability for us to play that security guarantor role. It's certainly true that over time, the logic of that position has, you know, I would say, contracted a bit, and that some people would rather say, let the countries in the region take more responsibility for their own security. Interestingly, I do think these latest small skirmishes that involve both Iran and the Saudis, and I'm not suggesting that the attack on the Saudi oil fields was small, it was very dramatic and significant. Those guys have a way of signaling to each other, you know, what's the red line? When is enough enough? The U.S. presence has always created this expectation that we could go big if we have to, that the U.S. has, you know, such firepower that we could really go and punish the Iranians if we have to. I'm not sure that's what they want right now. And maybe Trump is also hearing that in his conversations with the Saudis that, you know, so that there's another way to manage the, are there new ways of managing security in the Gulf? And is the American security guarantor role shifting a bit? I don't think it's a black and white situation. I don't think we'll go from, you know, all in to zero. There'll be something in between. But it is an interesting moment to see how do we recalibrate and find a new equilibrium in what is our responsibility and role for the security of Gulf oil and for the security of the Gulf states.
On Twitter, at @CarrieMPR, where Mark says foreign policy, besides praising dictators and cowering before a true alpha dog Putin, Trump's take on TPP took working with allies off the table, left him with only one tool, tariffs, which are harming our farmers and consumers. What foreign policy? Not great. And Nikki in Moorhead. Hi, Nikki. Appreciate you waiting.
Hi. I just wanted to bring into the conversation the fact that it was reported in October 2018 that a Saudi prince named Al-Waleed bin Talal in 1991, excuse me, and 1995 saved Donald Trump from bankruptcy. Much of his foreign policy is based on enriching himself, protecting his financial interests. He has been bankrupt several times, and he hasn't been able to access money through American means. He's been receiving foreign cash for decades now. And that's all I wanted to bring into the conversation.
Yeah, Ellen, when we talk foreign policy, we hear the kind of skepticism that Nikki is bringing into the conversation. Do you pick up on that?
I think we are in a very unusual situation where the president defiantly did not recuse himself or, you know, create kind of trust for all of his business interests when he came into office, which would be the normal expectation. I mean, there's, you know, lots of White House lawyers who tell incoming political people who've won elections, you know, what they can and cannot do and what the protocols are of, you know, how you're supposed to really put all of your personal business interests in blind trusts and remove them from, you know, in any way influencing your behavior as an elected official. President Trump has been very casual and a little bit dismissive and defiant of that established, those established norms. So I think your callers are quite correct, in my view, that there is this intermingling of his personal financial self-interest and his public office. And the most recent caller, I think it's a very interesting point that Trump also has these pre-existing relationships with foreign leaders, foreign influentials, because of those business ties. And so that probably does shape his views on, you know, gee, Saudi Arabia, those princes, I really get along with them well. Hmm. I like them. You know, that it would for sure shape his views, even though he doesn't have national security intelligence experience and his... But he would have those pre-existing attitudes and feelings and judgments about some of these foreign countries and their, you know, elite figures.
Ellen Lapson with us from George Mason University, and to the phones to Janet in St. Paul. Janet, thanks so much for waiting. Interested to hear what you have to say here.
I am extremely concerned about human rights, and it appears to me that the administration is simply not just backpedaling, but simply ignoring human rights and the many, many institutions we have tried to put in place following World War II for the last 75 years. I mean, somebody has to lead, and particularly in when the reporter Khashoggi, that whole thing, I think Trump sent a very, very clear signal that business interests and are primary, and human rights are not even on the radar screen. And so, I'm very concerned about that.
Ellen, do you think, Janet's clearly worried that the United States moral authority on human rights is diminishing. Is that a legitimate concern?
Yes, I think it's a very important issue of whether we have walked away from the values part of American engagement in the world, so that everything is transactional, economic self-interest, you know, protecting our security interests. The United States was always a very distinctive, maybe unique country in combining both a kind of idealism with a pragmatism. So I quite agree with Janet that we have push those issues down as universal values, so that we would not, this administration, for example, would not raise with the Egyptians how many political prisoners there are or the treatment of journalists, etc. Where I think the Trump administration would try to defend itself is on things like religious freedom, any Americans who are held hostage or who are, you know, perhaps prisoners in whether it's North Korea or Iran or somewhere else. So they would, again, take a very America-first approach to the issue, not a kind of universal values approach.
You interact with young Americans every day, I would assume, in your teaching. And I was reading something that John Della Volpe released from Harvard. It's a poll that they completed in late spring. And what they found was that 18 to 29-year-olds who are Republicans say that preventing the rise of terrorist groups is the most important goal of foreign policy. Democrats between 18 and 29 say that promoting human rights, something that Janet called to talk about, is the most important goal. And here's something else that I think is really interesting from the poll. Both 18 to 29-year-olds of both parties put very little emphasis on promoting the spread of democracy around the world. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, those are really interesting results. I was expecting you to say was something about climate change, that whether they think that climate change is going to be the kind of organizing principle for their lives as they grow into adulthood. So I wonder whether, I'm just speculating here, whether they are living in an environment where, you know, democracy is messy. It's not very pretty. There is an erosion of confidence in democratic institutions in the most mature democracies, whether it's the UK or the US. I mean, the newer democracies perhaps are still feeling a little more idealistic about their form of governance, but there is an erosion of respect for big institutions because they don't always perform in a timely or effective way. So maybe these young people are absorbing that attitude and they no longer, and or they have adjusted to a world of transactions where it's not our job to be trying to impose our system or project our values onto other societies. You know, let other countries be what they want to be. And I do think that promoting democracy, you know, we look at the environment after the Arab Spring.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
Our relationship with China. Yeah. There's a lot of places where American professional democracy promoters, and there is a whole cohort of people who do this very well, are no longer welcome. Or they're working under very difficult circumstances.
Call here from Bill in River Falls. Hi, Bill. Appreciate you waiting.
Yeah, thank you, Carrie. Good morning.
Morning.
I'll try to make this succinct because when I called in, the initial premise was, does the foreign policy, based on the fact that we really don't need the Middle East for oil, you know, give us an opportunity to change Middle East policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, you know, at the surface, I can agree with that premise. It's time to revisit that. If this is a sustainable change in, say, energy balance. However, the thing that got me thinking was this issue of policy and that Trump has none. And if our policies are really based on agreements and alliances, even if they're bilateral, you have to have someone whose word you can trust. And we have a government and now a Congress that supports a capricious, sycophant, opportunistic liar. So how can anyone trust us? You know, why would even any Britain even go into a bilateral agreement with Trump and the Trump administration just because of how frequently he changes his policies, his minds, and so on?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the issue of the Middle East is 10 times more complicated.
Ellen, I assume that it's a really good question that Bill raises. I assume they take the long view. Is that part of it?
Yes, but I think this very important issue of the erosion of trust cuts across at many, many levels. It's not just the incumbent president. It's, you know, societal relations, how groups interact with each other, you know, our wariness of talking to people that we know hold a different political view than we hold. So I think that erosion of trust is really a profound issue for all of us. I mean, at the, you know, community level as well as at the national level. I do think that foreign governments and foreign societies are, yes, on the one hand, they can look at the president and say, well, he's, by the Constitution, he could only run for maximum 2 terms, so he won't be there forever, and we still think the United States is a remarkably wonderful, positive, you know, country in the world. So some people are taking the long view, but I think others are saying President Trump is a symptom, not a cause, of a contraction of American influence and power in the world. So they think the problem is bigger than just the incumbent president.
I think that brings us right back to something that you said at the beginning that I didn't want to miss, which is the way Europeans see this and the way Asia sees this. So to what you've just said about this larger issue of contraction and insularity, how does that read in Asia, and what does it mean for our relationship with a country like China?
So I think the Asians, and it's so hard to generalize, it's, you know, a third of the world's population and wealth, et cetera. It's a complex. There are poor countries, there are very rich countries, but certainly the story of Asia's rise from, you know, the late 20th century well into this 21st century is one of the most remarkable stories of, you know, the human experience. And along with that wealth is much more confidence, much more shedding off of old, you know, deference to the West, of, you know, belief that somehow the West was the dominant culture in the world and that Asia somehow had to adapt to this, you know, prevailing culture. You know, we always talk about the liberal international order that emerged after World War II. Well, it's really the international Western order, and the Asians are now saying, maybe we've got some other ideas. So we do see, you know, China creating institutions that could be, you know, either competitors or alternatives to some of the Western-created institutions that we all know, the World Bank, the IMF, the UN itself. Here we have this remarkable rise of China, and many of China's immediate neighbors would prefer to have balance in relations with China and the United States. But when push comes to shove, for sure, they're going to have try to do as much as they can to have a normal and positive relationship with China. They don't know whether the United States is going to be there anymore as their protector and guarantor, and we never had an alliance system in East Asia comparable to what we had in Europe. We have individual bilateral alliances with Australia, Japan, Korea, security cooperation with Thailand, with some other Philippines, some other countries of more limited alliance relationships. So there never was a sort of unifying system of which the United States was the creator and the provider, if you will. So Asia is off on its own anyway, and I do think the Chinese are signaling in much more direct terms than they had in the past that they've got ideas about how the world should run, and they expect to be accepted as a global leader.
Yeah. Call here from Sam in Eagan. Hi, Sam.
Yeah, I just wanted to give another opinion on why 18 to 29-year-olds don't particularly value spreading democracy as a value.
Yeah, good.
Well, see, I'm a little older than that, but what I think of is I think of Iraq, where we went in to spread democracy and find WMDs, and there weren't any WMDs.
Mm-hmm.
And even when it does work, and that didn't really work out, and even when it does work, as in the Arab Spring kind of spread democracy, it didn't really have results that I think of as particularly good for America or the world. So, So why should we value that as something we should really prioritize in global policy when it's not necessarily going to have good results?
Yeah. You know, Ellen, I want to do a whole show on this based on some of what Sam just said. What this generation, what younger Americans see about this experiment that America has been engaged in for so long, and then the consequences of that, and then what that means, right, for our rising leaders who will be the ones that execute foreign policy someday soon.
Yeah, and I think it's a great topic, and it is a reminder that the scars from the Iraq experience are still playing out in different ways. So I really appreciate that comment. It really is insightful.
Can I ask you what you also make of the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu, now I haven't seen this morning what's happening in Israel, but he canceled his travel to the UN after it appeared that this government was going to be formed without him. He was a close ally of President Trump's. How will our relationship with Israel change if it's not Netanyahu running the show? And if a new administration comes in, what will that mean as well?
So I think some people were disturbed after such a long history of Israeli-American relations being a very bipartisan issue, that, you know, there was support for Israel across the American political spectrum and support across the Israeli political spectrum. You know, whether it was Labor in the good old days, you know, Labor was the alternate party with Likud. Now Labor is a much, much smaller share of the Israeli electorate. So I think some people think that maybe this will be a return to a normal, more bipartisan relationship. Bibi Netanyahu's bond with Donald Trump was so remarkably strong that Prime Minister Netanyahu was almost appearing like his relationship was with the Republican Party, not yeah. with the United States more broadly. So if it's an all-parties government, you know, a national coalition government or a Gantz blue and white led government, I think people expect that it would be a little bit of a sigh of relief that we can not have Israel becoming yet another partisan issue. But we're not there yet. And my understanding is that, you know, there's still some chance that Bibi Netanyahu will make a pitch to the president of Israel, who gets to decide who tries to form a government first, that his coalition is stronger than anything Benny Gantz can produce, even though Gantz's coalition came in with 3 seats more than the Likud coalition. So it's a very complicated dance of patching together these smaller parties. One of the delicate issues right now is that if there were a new government led by the blue and white coalition, do they need the support of the Arab parties, which came in very strong, 13 seats in
right.
the parliament?
Yeah.
That would be a source of enormous friction in Israeli politics, whether you include in the governing coalition the Arab parties. I think the Arab parties are clever enough and sophisticated enough to say, we don't want to be in the coalition, but we will support the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
So they could be technically opposition, but they would vote in favor of Gantz's prospects. But this is all still ad ref. You know, we still don't know how this is going to play out when the Israeli president has to decide which of the two front runners have the better chance of forming a government.
Okay, I'm really glad you gave us some insight on that, because there just hasn't been a lot of news about what's happening in Israel because of all this Ukrainian stuff. So really appreciate that. A call here from Jacob in Minneapolis. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Kathy. So I'm just commenting about something I heard earlier about young people not wanting to spread democracy abroad. So
yeah, that was the result of a poll. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a 29-year-old with I got brothers and family who are vets, but my mom's also a refugee. And, you know, each time I hear our political leaders talk about spreading democracy abroad, that ends up being code for we're going to commit violence to steal resources from black and brown people across the globe. So I'm highly suspicious of any time our political leaders talk about spreading democracy, because it's really code for colonization.
And Jacob, I think Mallory here on Twitter believes much the same thing. She says, to me as a millennial, I see it as similar to trying to spread Christianity across the world. In my opinion, we should stop trying to impose our views on everyone else. I think emphasizing human rights is more important. You know, Ellen, it's going to be really interesting to see how these views of this rising generation start to influence the way America's foreign policy takes shape. I mean, look at someone like Pete Buttigieg, right? This is a generation that is going to come into some pretty influential leadership roles in government fairly soon. What's your take on that, having the discussions with your students as you do and hearing what our callers are saying?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I do think that, some of our students are still, you know, excited about being in public service. They want to, you know, work in the intelligence community. They want to, you know, work at the State Department and do economic development. So we in the Washington area still see some students very much committed to public service. I listen with respect to evolving views, and I kind of liked the distinction perhaps of maybe human rights is a sustainable value that, you know, future generations would still support as part of the American portfolio of things that we do when we engage with foreign countries and foreign societies, but maybe less of the, you know, promoting a particular form of government or institutions. So let's see how that plays out. As long as there is still a values component to American foreign policy, I personally would feel that there's at least some continuity.
You must wonder, I have about 2 minutes left, but you must wonder how whoever is doing your job in 25 years or historians will look back at this moment, given Brexit, given the what's happening in China, and given what's happening in the United States. Do you have some questions that you think may be answered down the road?
You know, I think until a couple of years ago, it was hard to say whether this was really a turning point moment or whether we were in some, you know, cosmic shift. Mm-hmm. And now I think it's staring us in the face, that there is some realignment of power relationships in the world. There's a redefinition of the role of nation states and do we trust institutions or not. So, I mean, having enjoyed being in, you know, I was in government for 25 years in the 70s and 80s, actually through the 90s as well, whether that period was a more idealistic age or that we enjoyed the benefits of the United States being, you know, an important power, big mistakes were made, but does one still believe that you could net out that the United States was a force for good in the world, not just, you know, the mistakes of Vietnam, the mistakes of Iraq, obviously those hang heavy over many people. But I really don't know what it will feel like to be in a world where the United States is a great power but not a superpower anymore. It's a very different set of assumptions we make about how the world works.
Really grateful for the time this morning, Ellen, and the analysis. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ellen Lapson with us from George Mason University.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.